Hello and welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, your conference co-host. Today, I'm speaking with Britt Frank, a licensed neuropsychotherapist and author of The Science of Stuck. Britt received her undergraduate degree from Duke University and her master's degree from the University of Kansas, where she later became an award-winning adjunct professor. Britt's work equips audiences with powerful and simple science-backed tools to help them get from stuck to go. Her new book, The Getting Unstuck Workbook, is out now. Britt, thank you so much for joining me today.
So good to be back with you. Thanks for having me on.
So I loved the workbook and noted that you could have started it in a lot of ways, but you began it with tackling procrastination. So why is that? And also, did you write that chapter first or last?
I procrastinated the procrastination chapter. No, you know, it's one of the first things that is one of the easier things for me to write about and speak about because it's so universal. You know, not everyone has a mental health challenge, or at least not an identified one. But we all know what procrastination feels like, the shame of being stuck with it. And not that it's easy, but when we understand procrastination is self-protective and not intended to be destructive, it flips the switch and the shame thing goes away and then we can actually get moving again. So I really love dismantling all the myths and shamey stuff around procrastination.
Yeah, you actually dismantle a lot of myths and shamey stuff throughout the whole book, and we're going to get to a lot of that. So yeah. All right. And you talk about kind of consistency over intensity. Like, I took so many notes in this book because yeah, I was like, absolutely. And what is a procrastination a sign of around like your nervous system? You said it's protective. So what's it trying to tell us?
Yeah. And the consistency over intensity, it's a relationship principle. I think I first heard that phrase from James Clear in Atomic Habits, but it's so true because we attack these goals of ours with this huge intent and we try to bite off more than we can chew. And from a nervous system standpoint, what our brains think shouldn't be a thing might be a very big deal. So the don't sweat the small stuff doesn't work if your nervous system thinks small stuff is big stuff. And procrastination is often the dissonance, this intersection between what I think I should be able to do and what my nervous system thinks it can do. And the nervous system's interpretation will win every time. So procrastination is a sign of nervous system overload. Why? I don't know. We don't always know, and that's okay. That's the nice part. You don't need to know why. But if you take it from a nervous system perspective rather than a moral, what's wrong with me? I'm such a lazy person. There are changes that can be made here. If it's just who you are, then there's nothing to be done. End game. So I like this approach, one, because it's based in science, and two, because it actually produces change rather than the shame cycle that then produces more stuff that creates more shame, and onward we go.
All right. So now we understand kind of what's happening in us when we're procrastinating and how it's protecting us. And some of the things that you talk about around that are systems. So why are systems so important when we're trying to meet our goals?
So without a system, most things don't get done. So you would never build a house without a blueprint. You would never launch a business. Well, some people do. It doesn't tend to go well when big things are done without some sort of system or plan to contain the requirements of them. But again, we approach goal setting with, well, it's January 1st, so I might as well start trying to do the big thing, ignoring the fact that in fourth quarter, likely chaos, holidays, family obligations, breaks from school and kids, and you're probably at the lowest bandwidth January 1st of the entire year, plus the hangover if you're a drinker. So systems are sort of the, let's get this work done ahead of time. Before you try to do the thing, let's create a system so we can set you up to do the thing based on your specific, because not every tool technique works for everybody, but the idea of create a system that is U-shaped, that can work for everybody because it means whatever you need it to mean. But systems usually have to come before change in order to make the change last sustainably.
And I love how you kind of introed systems as well. You talk about the intention action gap. And it was so funny. I have to share this with you. While I was reading it, I was envisioning that famous photo that was in the Patagonia catalog of the two parents throwing the baby over the crevasse. If anybody's ever seen, just literally just Google parents throwing baby across canyon and the image will come up, because that was kind of the intention action gap imagery that I was getting as I was reading that part of the book, because we're not often modeled in our personal lives, sometimes in our professional lives, but we're not modeled in our personal lives how to bridge the gap between our intentions and our systems, or our goals and our systems. And you talk kind of about the four S's. So I would love if you can kind of break those down for us so that we're not throwing the baby across the canyon.
It's such a great metaphor, because it's true. It's set the goal, now jump. Like, but if you jump, you're going to fall, because jumping a 100-foot canyon isn't. Maybe some people, maybe some babies, but no. So instead of just jump, it's let's build the bridge. And so, you know, creating structures like systems, finding cheat codes to starting, that's a big one. Is we talk about we need to get started and it's so hard to get started. And once I get to the gym, I'm fine, but getting myself to go, let's solve for that. Rather than focusing on the finish line, how do you solve for the starting line? I haven't seen a ton of material on that. And it could be as simple as, you know, practice putting your clothes out the night before, or drive to the place so your nervous system can get oriented to it. But we want to solve for the entire canyon when we need to just put the first brick of the bridge into place. And I have the same response as most people. That's going to take so much time. Like, how am I supposed to get anything done if I just don't do it? It's like, well, you can do it and then fall and then climb back up and try again and then fall and then climb back up, or take the time to build the bridge that will sustain you as you're making the nerve, you know, as you're making changes, because our nervous systems don't like changes. Like, a predictably negative outcome to a brain is preferable than possibility or some sort of unknown, maybe it's going to be good kind of situation. So we got to solve for that.
Absolutely. And I love the acronym that you made when you're, especially when you're talking about starting, which is like the small, easy, truthful. And I love that last part, the truthful part. I think we all understand what small means. We all understand what easy means. What do you mean by truthful?
Yeah, I love acronyms. So in the goal part, I'm like SET, S-E-T, small, easy, truthful. Because how often do we lie to ourselves? Like, I went to an early morning Pilates class, and I knew when I signed up for an early morning, I knew I wasn't going to go when I signed up for that class. I mean, this is not going to happen. I'm going to wake up tomorrow at 5 and get really annoyed and turn my alarm off and go back to sleep. If I had been truthful with myself the day before, I could have solved for that. There's no point in trying to do something that you're not ready to do or unwilling to do or can't do. So we have to not only make our goals small and easy, but they have to be truthful. And that's where shadow work comes into play. It's like, I feel ashamed that I'm not a morning person. Okay, but that's a bigger problem. Right now, we're just trying to solve for your morning workout routine. So small, easy, truthful. We have to start there. We don't have to. It helps too.
Yeah. And talk about, you know, like self-compassion of just, we don't have to accept like the shamey labels. Like, lazy is one of those shamey labels you talk about in the book, right? Like, are we lazy, or are we just valuing rest or restoration, or accepting the characteristics about ourselves? Like, I just recently hurt my leg, and I've been in a walking cast for several weeks. And in order to get in some cardio, I started to swim. And I've had to admit to myself that I don't want to get in a giant cold body of water in the morning, even if it's fashionable. I don't want to do it. I can do it at midday. I can do it in the afternoon, but I'm not going to wake up at 5 a.m. and go swim laps. And so just being truthful with myself about that, right? Like, I didn't have to book a class, but I also, like, the alarm's going to go off and my body's going to go, hell no. Like, let's be truthful so we can succeed. And then I can plan around my own truth, right?
And it's truth without shame, right? If you had sat there and beat yourself up, you would have created more nervous system overload. So I'm very yay self-compassion, but not just from the just be nice to yourself, because there's a chemical pathway that truth without shame follows. than the chemical pathway that truth while beating yourself up for what you find. This one produces change. This one produces more of the thing that we don't want. So getting rid of shame isn't making excuses or co-signing. It's creating a very difficult, a different chemical pathway to get us where we want to go in the first place.
Yeah. And so much of, I think that's the work that people avoid the most is not, it's the sitting with the shame of it and teasing it apart and admitting it and then being like, okay, so what work do I need to do in order to not feel shame around this and get past it? How do we even begin that? Yeah.
I actually have an answer to that. And I'm very fond of this answer because it's such a hot take, but it's so true. And as a therapist, I'm saying, don't start with why. Don't start with why. Start with why is great if you're launching a business. And start with why is brilliant in that realm of work. But when you are stuck and you are trying to solve for starting something, why can't I start it is not usually helpful. Like sometimes can it be helpful? Maybe. But more often than not, rather than why am I stuck, it's what are my realistic choices here? Of those, what am I willing to say yes to? That will get you moving a lot faster than analysis doesn't get you across the canyon. I can sit there and think about the canyon and how the canyon came to be and what tectonic plates needed to shift. Doesn't help. Where's the brick? What do I need to do next? What am I willing to do next? What's available to me is a great way to get around the shame problem.
Absolutely. I love that. What, not why.
Yeah.
What? All right. So obviously we're kind of dancing around it, but let's talk about safety in stuckness. And why is safety important enough when we're trying to get, you know, achieve our goals or make change?
The safety issue is so interesting, right? Because unless you're actually in a physically or biologically unsafe environment, most people who are stuck in the type of stuck we're talking about are logically safe. Like there's not a lethality to not going to the gym or to laying on the couch. Like if you feel bad, it's not because you're unsafe. But our brains don't know that because our brains' operating systems, they don't upgrade. So instead of this shouldn't feel unsafe to my brain, which is the argument usually when we talk about fight, flight, freeze and the nervous system's shutdown safety responses. Well, why is it doing that? It shouldn't do that. Okay, well, we're not going to ask why. We're not going to do that. It's doing it because brain. That's because your brain is braining. That's why. So rather than, well, why is it feeling unsafe when it shouldn't? A better question is, what are the things that cue safety? That's a question I never was asked growing up. I never learned to solve for safety. It was just implied, you're safe, get over it. What's wrong with you? But practicing, noticing what people feel safe to my nervous system, what places, what songs, what shows, what food, what does safety even feel like? Because we can't solve the problem of safety if we don't know what safety even feels like. And that takes time and practice because I don't know about you, I lived in a floating head. So where do you feel safe in your body was a strange, I didn't understand the assignment for a long
yeah.
time.
Yeah, I spent years in therapy with that question floating in the room. So what does that feel like in your body? And I would be like, I don't understand. it took years. Yeah, exactly. And the question of what feels safe to you, you know, and we'll get to this in a few minutes. I've got some questions down the pike here around relationships, because you spent a lot of time in the kind of the relationship realm in the workbook, but I'm not there yet. We're not going there yet. Okay. Teaser for everybody watching at home. and so when we're talking about safety, I want to talk about positive thinking, right? And why is mindset not enough to change your mind if you want to change your mood?
No shade to the cognitive behavioral therapy people. CBT is sort of like the ballet of the mental health world. It's the basics. You need the basics. The basics are important. But if mindset was the sole issue, we'd all be good to go because we all know how to say, come on, get up off the couch and do the thing. I am a winner. Like we can do affirmations all day, but mindset is limited because there's only one part of your brain that does mindset. And that's the newer part. And that part is very easily shut down by the safety parts of the brain that have been around for a lot longer than the modern demands of a modern day world. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's that part of your brain, you know, the safety parts of your brain are like the bouncer outside that won't even let you get in to hear the band you came to see. Like that's if you don't assuage the bouncer and make sure that like your ID checks out and you don't have anything in your purse that would be like you have to get checked out first, and then those higher thinking parts of your brain can then get access, right? Am I understanding that right?
I love that. I haven't heard that analogy yet. And I love it because the bouncer is big and scary and mean, but you're the club owner. You own your inner space. And so the bouncer works for you. And when we're fighting with ourselves and thinking, you know, my physiology is out to get me and, you know, I'm self-sabotaging and my brain is attacking me, we forget our brains are on our side and brains are not wired for peak performance. Brains are wired for don't die. And so we can change the default settings, but we have to start with, this isn't a moral thing. This isn't a character thing. Mindset is limited because brain, and because brain is attached to body.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was thinking of another analogy when you were talking, who knows if these are helpful to people, but it's like when you're in a car and the seatbelt gets locked and it's too tight and you're just like, and like no amount of pulling is going to loosen it. You have to actually chill the heck out and like take a breath and relax. And then magically the seatbelt will loosen and you're like, okay, like all of that has to happen before you can then get into like rational reasoning with your brain. And if before you can start thinking positively, you have to acknowledge all of the stuff that's going on. Like, okay, I don't feel safe. And like, you know, your rational mind's going to be like, that's dumb, right? It can think all at once, but you still got to like address the safety issue first and foremost. And we talk about safety a lot here. So,
which is why I don't like positive thinking, because positive thinking ignores the safety problem. Negative thinking ignores the problem of not everything is bad, unless it is, but most of the time it's not. So rather than even trying with positive thinking, let's go with what's true here. And then asking yourself, is this true? Was this ever true? How true is it now?
And positive thinking, I think too, for a lot of people, feels just like the messages they got when they were younger from people of like, oh, it's not that scary, or, you know, you're totally safe, you know, or it's not that bad, or, you know, right. It's just you doing that to yourself. So it feels really familiar and really easy. And it feels like something that should work because it sort of worked when you were little to at least change your state or pretend or stuff it or all those things. So it's a familiar tactic that we can use, but it doesn't mean it works, right?
It's so true. And it's not even positive, right? Yeah. Like, I just need to get over myself and do the thing because there's nothing to be scared of. That is not positive. That's kind of like gaslighting. It's like, no, it's scary. It's okay to be scared. That is that whatever the thing is you want to do, if it's something your brain's not used to, scary is probably going to be the feeling. And that, again, that's how brains brain, and it makes sense, and we can work with it instead of fighting against it.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, like the protective mechanisms of anxiety, what they're meant to do. And so you also list the four P's of anxiety, one of them obviously being protect, but you also mentioned prevent, promote, and point. So I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, anxiety as a promotional, we're talking about the bouncer, right? So anxiety is sort of like promoting that he's the promoter, she or they are the promoter outside the club, trying to recruit other people, because anxiety does promote connection. It is a lot easier to bond with someone in a high stress situation than on a regular Tuesday. So flights and air travel is the best example of this. When there's something really wrong, watch how fast you are bonding and making friends with the neighbors. I was on a bad flight and I'm holding hands with the guy across the aisle. I've never met him. I don't know who he is, but I'm anxious because the plane is bouncing and we're missing our approach. I'm holding his hand. Anxiety does promote connection. And in a increasingly isolating feeling worlds, we need connection. And if we're not getting it through conscious means, our brains will tee up the anxiety just as a strategy to not feel so lonely, which isn't healthy and it's not good, but it is functional. And again, it's so important to consider, oh, It is easier to bond and connect with people when there's something bad happening. It's harder when there's something good happening. So that's something to consider as I'm thanking anxiety for doing its job. And it does point towards areas that need our attention. It's like a smoke alarm. The smoke alarm doesn't attack the house. The smoke alarm is a very unpleasant signal that there is a problem somewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we've mentioned it over and over again, so I just want to really just say it explicitly, which is, when you respect your brain and your anxiety and get curious instead of shamey and judgmental about it in yourself, it loosens up. I can just attest to, you know, we've been talking in these interviews for over 3 years now. And like, I hear your voice in my head all the time, in a good way, in a healthy way. And I hear the things that you've said to me and I use them, and it's just changed my relationship with my own anxiety and the way that I receive it. And the questions that I ask it, I never ask why anyway. I only ask what, like, what are you trying to tell me? What am I not getting? What is coming up? Right. And then the minute, I just had an example of this last week where I got triggered by something on a day that I didn't want to be triggered by something, right? And I just had to sit down for 30 minutes with a journal and like a pen and be like, what are you trying to get me to feel? What are you trying to communicate? What do you need? What do you want? Wrote. And then it was over. I was like, oh, okay, great. I can move on now. Message received. Thank you for your communication. Like, and now I can move through it instead of just fighting tooth and nail against it and denying it all day or feeling bad about the fact that I was feeling bad. You just go through it.
And it's terrifying. I haven't had what we used to call panic attacks, because we know panic doesn't attack, but I had one of those recently. I haven't had one in years. And I was like, oh man, I have to now practice all this stuff I talk about. Okay. Because it did. It felt so just awful. I'm like, what can I do to numb out, to make it go away? And I'm like, all right, I know what to do. My brain is on my side. My brain is on my side. My brain is on my side. I'm not being attacked. That at least got it from a 10 to an 8. Then there's a message here. Okay, like, fine, I don't have to like this right now, but I do know, don't ask why, ask what, right? That got it down from an 8 to a 6. And then once I got it down enough, then suddenly the seatbelt loosened and I was like, oh, that made sense that I would just have, I got triggered. I was in a city where a bad thing happened. It's like, oh yeah, that makes sense that my body would remember being there and produce anxiety physiology. But if I had asked why while I'm locked down, I would have just felt worse.
Yeah. And it's so funny because when we don't have this information, a lot of times when we're triggered, and especially if we have a trauma history or something, we take our state and we seek out someone who can validate it for us. And who, that could be a therapist, it could be a friend, it could be a partner, who can say, that makes sense because of, right? And when you learn how to do that for yourself, and because you understand, because your higher level thinking isn't available to you most of the time, unless you know all this stuff and you practice it like you and I do. And so that high level thinking isn't available to you. And all you're in is like, I feel like this and I need someone to validate my experience and tell me I'm not crazy, or that feeling like this isn't crazy. But when you're able to slow down and just be like, my brain is my friend, my brain is my friend, like you just described, then the higher level thinking starts to come back on and you can self-validate. You can hear the voice of your therapist. You can hear the voice of your friend. You can hear the voice of the wise people you listen to at these conferences who are saying, okay, what is possible? What is happening? What do I need to know? What am I here to learn? And then if you can't get to it, right, still, then you use your phone a friend. You text your therapist, whatever you support you have in your life. And I hope everybody has at least someone, if not. So yeah, absolutely. You end up being able to kind of self, regulate. That's the word I'm looking for, without having to constantly seek validation. Right.
And even if you don't know why the affirmation, this makes sense, I don't know why it makes sense, but I do know just because brain is on my side, it makes sense that you do not need any type of advanced training or understanding of anything to start at least practicing. I don't know why it makes sense, but it does, because it always makes sense in context. It's a great starting place when you don't know what to do. Start by affirming, I'm not crazy, because there's no such thing as a crazy person. And this does make sense. Somewhere this makes sense, and I will hopefully figure it out. But if I don't, that's okay. What do I need? What am I willing to do? What are my choices?
Absolutely. I have to tell you, when I was reading the workbook, I was surprised when I got to the relationships part, because I think in my brain, I was like, we're just talking about individual stuff, blah, blah, blah. And then there was this, and I was like, oh, but at the same time, I was so excited because you talked about the relationship of like counseling and safety. And it was so funny because my partner came from across the house. He was like, what? Because I stood up and I was like, yes, as I was reading it. Because it's one of my like major points of contention around therapy is just that everybody's like, well, you should go to couples therapy. And a lot of times when people are saying what their problems are in their relationships, people aren't fully disclosing because they also don't understand everything that's going on in their relationships. They just understand how they feel and they don't understand why they feel it. And so they can't name or can't say like, I'm in an unsafe or abusive relationship, because they don't actually know it. They just know like there's a lot of things going on that don't make sense and how I feel doesn't make sense and I need some help. People say, okay, go to couples counseling. Well, if you don't have fundamental safety in your relationship, couples counseling can be really dangerous and unsettling and unhelpful. So I want you to talk about it, even though I just did a bunch of talking.
I mean, I want to stand up and cheer for you cheering for this, because it's true. And the research has shown, and the domestic violence hotline people that spend all of the resources and energy into the research and understanding these dynamics, couples therapy is not helpful when abuse is present in a relationship. Now, again, I've had people, that is not true. And there's cultural context and there are other things, and what is really abuse and which type of abuse counts and which doesn't. But generally speaking, of course, there's nuance to everything. If there is abuse if there's abuse present, that's not a relationship problem. Abuse is not a communication problem. Abuse is not a relational dynamic problem. Abuse is a problem of an abuser not doing what they need to do so they don't abuse. And so I don't do couples therapy anymore, but I would have people come to me for couples therapy, and it's absolutely not, because when you have couples therapy, we're balancing it out and we're looking at both sides of the situation. And there are many abusive situations where there's not two sides to that story. Abuse is abuse. Period. So yeah, I will stand behind the other people who are smarter than I am, who've done all the research, that when abuse is present in a relationship, couples therapy, not recommended.
And I will say, because I have experienced this personally, that unsafe situations don't necessarily have to be permanent. Like there could be a dynamic that is initiated by stress and by other outside mitigating factors that could make a relationship feel very, very unsafe. And so couples counseling will still be unhelpful and problematic. So what I'm saying is couples counseling can be eventually helpful once safety is reestablished in the partnership. Once we have like communicated, here are the boundaries, here is what helps me feel safe. And once we have engaged in that like baseline again, of safety that we allegedly probably had at some point, if we even got into a relationship, once that is reestablished, then we can go into couples counseling and talk about how we got here in the first place and how we can improve our communication and how to avoid these pitfalls in the future. So it's not all hopeless. Like there are some situations where couples counseling will be helpful and where safety can be reestablished, but abuse is not one of them.
It's really not. And the vulnerability required to successfully do couples counseling then gets weaponized. And we see this in the media all the time when people use therapy speak as a way to control and to, you know, it's very dangerous when an abusive partner knows enough about psychology to then be able to say, you know, nope, you're triggered. You're projecting onto me. It's like, I'm going to hit you and then tell you you're projecting because I know what projection is. It's like, no, you're being abusive. I get it's complicated and it's nuanced and it's difficult. And I stand by that. Abuse is not a situation where couples therapy is appropriate. Like in a perfect world, everyone would have access to good therapy. And like, if you want to stay with your partner, go to your corners, work it out, and then come together after, like you said, safety has been established.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to make sure we talked about that. All right. So you talk about conflict languages, and it's great. Everybody should buy the book so that they can see that. But here's what I want to ask you. What about the couples that don't fight?
Two avoidance together is such an interesting dynamic. So the couples that don't fight are strange to me.
I think it's problematic, but if you're in a conflict avoidant relationship and you don't have a problem, I'm not going to create problems where there are none to be had. So I can look and judge people that don't fight and be like, oh, they're so avoidant. And oh my gosh, it would be so much better if, but if they're happy being conflict avoidant, okay. Like that could be very detrimental for children who are witnessing the refusal to engage in healthy conflicts. But two autonomous adults who want to sweep things under the rug, if children aren't involved, like have at it, do your thing. But yeah, not having any conflict is not very human because humaning is hard and conflict is inevitable. Fighting is optional, but conflict is inevitable. So skillful navigation through conflict is useful.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I want to talk about codependency because I've never heard it in this terms, which you named it as process addiction. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, I don't know why she had to attack me like this. But as someone who's been in a personal like codependency unwinding journey, right? Because we learned this over a long time. We don't just arrive in a relationship someday as a codependent, like, this takes time to learn these behaviors and patterns and modalities of relationship. And then when it becomes a problem in our relationships, we're like, oh, right, that's what that is. So how are codependency and process addiction related, and what is process addiction?
I really believe this and I get into trouble for saying it, but I can back it up. So first let's define what is a process addiction. So there's chemical addictions where you ingest something to alter how you feel or think. A process addiction is a repeated pattern of behavior that's causing problems and continues to repeat despite negative consequences. So technically sex addiction, you're ingesting a chemical, but like we'll call sex addiction because you're not injecting or snorting, gambling, overspending, anything where you're not ingesting a chemical is considered a process addiction. Codependency, and the word is really terrible because we do need each other as humans, but codependency is a process addiction in that it is a pattern that continues to repeat despite negative consequences and then continues to get reinforced and repeated. And when you say things like, I know this is a bad pattern, but I can't seem to stop, if that's not the definition of addiction, I don't know what is. And because I have it too in spades, the process of healing from codependency very much mirrors the process of healing from a chemical addiction. And I've done both, and they both require detox and withdrawal and discomfort and just really cringy, unpleasant, uncomfortable realizations. But looking at it as a type of addiction, even though that sounds bad, to me, freed up, because the path forward is very well tread for that. So let's follow that path, because people over there seem to have some ideas of how to walk forward. So let's go over there and do that. And then it tends to work because they do mirror each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you said in the book, when the only currency of connection is helping, you eventually believe that your only value comes from what you do rather than who you are. And I remember I just like paused and held the book against me. And I was like, oh, right. Like, I was like, I got to read that in the interview, because like, I really want people to like feel that in their chest, in their heart space. And I recently had an experience where somebody that I'm in a relationship with was going through a really hard thing that didn't have anything to do with me. And it took like 4 days of what you said, like the agony and the discomfort. And I could feel all of the things that I used to do and all the ways that I used to process that and all the ways that I used to show up. And it was a lot of agony to have the restraint, not to just fall into my regular coping patterns. Right. And so it's not comfortable work, but at the same time, the thing that I want people to hear and that you can say more about is that you're robbing the other person of their work if you're trying to codependently like do it for them and comfort them, like, especially if it doesn't have anything to do with you. Like, we're not talking about like things you need to make amends for, or, you know, grievances or apologies or things like that. If you don't have anything to do with the other person's state or stage, like, you shouldn't be doing the work to make them feel better. And stop robbing them of that incredibly vital work in their own personal development. Yeah.
It's tricky because people are like, well, are you telling me I should just be mean and selfish and not care? Like, aren't we supposed to offer and extend support and care to other people? And the answer to that is yes, of course. I'm not saying don't care. I am saying we need to examine how we care and the ways in which we are showing up. Sometimes the best way I could care for someone is to not help them, like you said, because if I come in and rescue somebody, I get the credit for that win, not them. And so as much as it's awful to see someone you care about suffering and in pain, and there are ways to show up that aren't codependent, you know, like I had to have a hard conversation with a friend. I'm a therapist. I'm not your therapist. This person had a substance abuse issue. If I take your call every time you're in crisis, I'm one telling you that you don't need therapy. You have your therapist friend who's on standby, but I'm also completely taking away your autonomy and agency. I provided a list of resources. That was a non-codependent way I could help. Like, here are people that are available to be your therapist. I'm a therapist, not yours. It's not kind or loving for me to help right now. And that's a hard, I mean, it's hard because as the helper, we feel uncomfortable when we're not helping, but that's our problem, not theirs. And sometimes the most loving thing to do is nothing.
And like you just stated, what is the difference between a request and a boundary?
This is one of my favorites because boundaries went from, I never heard the word boundaries growing up. And then everywhere in the zeitgeist on social media, it's boundaries, boundaries, which great, like yay boundaries. But when people say, well, my boundary is that you can't do this, that's not a boundary. That's you trying to control somebody. So a boundary never, and no one can actually cross your boundaries. That's another one that just sort of like, once you see it or hear it, you can't unhear it. A boundary is about me. It's about you. A boundary is a choice that I make in response to your behavior. It's not an ultimatum. It's if you do this, I will choose this. And the difference between an ultimatum and a boundary is our intents. An ultimatum is I want to control you. A boundary is if you call me after 9, I'm not going to answer. And that's not to control you. It's because I like you. I want to stay friends. And if you keep calling me late at night, I'm going to get resentful and our friendship is going to suffer. So a boundary is a fancy word for a choice. A boundary is just a choice. What's my choice? You do a thing. Now I have a menu of options. I might not like my choices, but a boundary is an inside job and it never depends on another person. So no one can cross your boundaries. If my boundary is I don't answer my phone after 9 and you call me, you didn't cross my boundary. You just didn't do something I asked you to do. I have to answer the phone in order for the boundary to be crossed. So the only person who can cross your boundaries is you, except in cases of abuse. If like my boundary is during a fight, I go into the room and you leave me alone and you break down the door, that's not a boundary violation. That's abuse.
Yes. And I just want to emphasize too that, and many people have said this, that boundaries are, again, not intended to control other people, and they're put into place in order to try to stay in relationship with people, right? Because we're breaking down these kind of patterns, it's codependency, if you will, or other, you know, relationship dynamics. And we're recognizing like, I've had to surrender too much of myself, or I haven't been paying enough attention to my needs or my self-care in this relationship. And therefore, in order to stay in relationship with you, I need to make this choice. And people hear the word boundaries and they misunderstand it. And they think that it's all about, you know, these unrealistic expectations that people are putting on other people. And they're like, no, actually, this is me trying to stay in relationship with you.
And it's about what's true. This goes back to the small, easy, truthful thing. If I have a boundary that is not compatible with how you live your life, like if our, like for our friendship, if my boundary is I don't like to text and you're a texter, there's going to be some fundamental incompatibility there. It doesn't mean you're wrong for wanting, this isn't you for real. This is for example. It doesn't mean you're wrong for wanting to text all day. It doesn't mean I'm wrong for never answering my phone. It just means what's true for me is incompatible with what's true for you. And that's a hard pill to swallow. But it is important as you're figuring out boundaries to be honest with yourself about what you will and what you won't deal with or tolerate in a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And they can be, you know, seemingly silly. Like one of my work boundaries is that I don't do voice memos. And it's a thing that we joke about and we laugh about because it's just, it gives me anxiety to see a big, like 6 minute voice note first thing in the morning. I'm like, oh no, it gives me this like existential dread. And so I'm like, once I communicate that, I'm like, I can't handle it. Like in this way, if you do it here because of convenience, because you're driving or whatever, then I get a transcript. If you send it to me over here, I will ignore it because I can't stand the anxiety. And like when you communicate, oh, then the other person's like, oh gosh, I never expected that a voice memo would give you anxiety. I'm like, yes, it totally does. Now there's some, I'm laughing because I just sent Britt voice memos last week, right? But it's up to her to express like, I really don't like, I don't want to receive or send voice memos. Stop communicating with me like that, right? Like if she didn't like it, she would do it. But that's what we're talking about. They don't have to be these big, like, and they also can be really important and very big. I have somebody in my life who struggles with substance use. And so my boundary is I love talking to you and I love communicating with you and I love our relationship, but I cannot communicate with you when you are under the influence. And that has changed our relationship because they are struggling with, you know, active substance use. And it hurts not to be actively in relationship with that person. But at the same time, I'm also really appreciative of the respect of that boundary. And so they don't always feel good, but they feel good ultimately to us when we communicate how we feel, right?
And someone could look at that and say, well, you're being mean. Your friend needs you. And it's like, but if you're being dishonest with yourself, how is you abandoning yourself to show up in a way that causes resentment? How is that, number one, kind? It's not. How is it helpful? It might be temporarily soothing to that person, but it's not ultimately helpful for anybody to be in a relationship with an undercurrent of resentment and self-abandonment. So even though they feel icky and they sound mean, the intention is always about love and protection.
Yeah, absolutely. Both of us, right? And that, you know, just so that people don't think I'm abandoning people, it's, you know, that is not when there's crisis, right? But crisis is also very relative to the, yeah, to the person who's in it. So I won't give you the details of all that for this relationship. But anyway, just to say that boundaries exist so we can stay in relationship. And that's kind of the bottom line. Britt,
sure.
How can people find out about your new workbook and about your work and what you're doing in the world?
I'm so excited about the workbook because I wrote it the way I like to do workbooks, and there's like different types of things and you can jump around and it's not all cognitive. It's not all journaling. There's lots of different types. So it's called the Getting Unstuck Workbook, and you can buy it wherever you buy books and find me on Instagram. I don't mind voice memos at all. That is not a boundary for me. And it's at Britt Frank or my website, scienceofstuck.com.
Fantastic. Britt, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.